things are not looking pretty there this morning at all. There was water around the fuel tanks. Water was everywhere.
The Kuskokwim River floods the village of Crooked Creek. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, May 9th. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the Goose Creek Correctional Facility opening is pushed back.
The department will reassess and move forward based on the figure that we are given.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska Fairbanks now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
It looks like it could be a high flood year for the Kuskokwim River, at least for the village of Crooked Creek along the Middle River, where high water has already inundated some homes. From members station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
About 20 people were evacuated from Crooked Creek this morning after high water started rising late Sunday night. Several people sought refuge in a two-story building in town, but they requested evacuation this morning after water continued to rise. Elderly and infants were airlifted out by workers with Donlin Creek, a gold mine site in the mountains near the village.
Things are not looking pretty there this morning at all. There was water around the fuel tanks. Water was everywhere.
Eric Holloway is a hydrologist with the National Weather Service. He's monitoring the river breakup as part of the River Watch program, which conducts daily aerial surveys.
What we saw from the air was actually homes lifted off foundations, ice into homes. I would describe it as major flooding at this point.
Phone service in Crooked Creek went down as well, making communication with the outside world difficult. However, Holloway says one person in the village has a satellite phone and has been keeping the River Watch team updated about every hour. Carl Edwards is the other part of the River Watch team. He is an emergency management specialist with the Alaska Emergency Coordination Center. He says Donlin Creek is keeping a helicopter in the area in case there needs to be any emergency evacuations. He says there are about a dozen people left in the flood area that they are paying special attention to right now.
They're going to weather it out, and they said if they have to, they'll hike up the mountainside and camp there tonight if the flooding gets worse.
Edwards has been in contact with the Emergency Coordination Center in Fort Richardson about the flooding. He says they have a team standing by that will come out and assess damages when the water recedes. He has also been talking with villages along the lower Kuskokwim River about preparing for possible flooding this year.
This is an interesting year as far as the ice goes, and it's really hard to predict what it's going to do. So we're trying to get that word out to people right now.
Part of what makes this year unique is the Thanksgiving breakup, which melted and then refroze part of the river into thick jumbles of ice, some 8 feet high. That happened a lot near the village of Aniak, about 50 miles downstream from Crooked Creek. It is expected that that part of the river will see breakup action in the next couple of days. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
The House and Senate return to Juneau today to begin the fourth week of the first 30-day special session of the year. Members have given no indication that they are any closer to settlement of the few remaining issues. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Lawmakers relieved a lot of pressure on Friday by passing the operating budget for next year. That now leaves only two issues to resolve this special session: passing what's become a contentious capital projects budget and authorizing the Coastal Management Program to prevent it from closing its doors this year. There's no visible progress towards reaching conclusions on either subject, however. Legally, the session has until Tuesday the 17th before it's required to adjourn, but that limit presumes there are goals that members want to reach. This year, there's been no definition of success. The Senate 2 weeks ago even suggested a cooling-off period until late this summer or early fall to complete the capital budget. The House rejected that idea, however. All the inactivity this month has led individual members to anticipate an earlier de facto deadline, this coming Saturday rather than Tuesday of next week. Saturday is when either the House or Senate can adjourn from the session and not be bound by the constitutional prohibition against more than a 3-day absence. On Saturday or later, neither the House nor Senate can be forced to return to the session, effectively ending the process. Until then, members are still privately negotiating the divisive points, but they're also stiffening their positions. The House and Senate both are trying to affect public opinion, too. The House Energy Committee Friday and Saturday reviewed the energy projects in the capital budget. No legislative action was tied to 8 hours of educational hearings. The House Judiciary Committee on Wednesday will also hold an educational session, discussing the contingency language in the budget that would prevent the governor from using his simple line-item veto. That issue is at the heart of the division between the House and Senate this year. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
The newly constructed state prison in the Matanuska Sioux Sittna Borough will most likely not open on time because the state operating budget passed on Friday does not contain enough of the funds requested by corrections officials. In March, the Senate Finance Committee cut the Goose Creek Correctional Facility startup funds, some $3.6 million, from the Senate version of the state operating budget because of concerns about the eventual cost to the state of running the prison. At the time, Senator Johnny Ellis said he was confident that the funds would be reinstated after conference committee talks.
The conference committee can take the House number or some lesser number, and I believe that there will be adequate funds to open Goose Creek on time.
But that has not been the case. The version of the state budget passed Friday contains a reduced amount for prison startup costs, some $2.4 million. Richard Schmitz is spokesman for the Department of Corrections.
The department, you know, is reevaluating how it's going to open the Goose Creek prison. The amount of funding that wasn't received, the difference between the $2.4 million and the $3.6 million, was planned to cover. There would have been a small contingent of inmates that would have been brought in with some staff, you know, obviously with correctional officers and other support staff. Instead, there's enough funding to cover the basics, the bond repayment, utilities, and to secure the buildings.
Schmitz says the original plan was to bring in a small group of prisoners to test the facility before opening the prison entirely. Now the available funds will be spent on bond debt and utilities. The Matanuska Sioux Sittna Borough built the 1,500-bed prison, which is 85% complete, and under an agreement with the state is leasing it to the state for 25 years. The idea behind the agreement was to provide in-state housing for about 1,000 Alaska prisoners now incarcerated in Colorado. Goose Creek operating costs are about $50 million a year, plus lease payments to the borough of almost $18 million a year. It costs $20 million a year to keep Alaska's prisoners in outside facilities. Goose Creek was scheduled to open in June of 2012. Schmitz says now that date will be delayed.
The fiscal year that was covered, the $2.4 million, it would cover about 3 months. So right now, we would just be looking at a delay in a ramp up of 3 months till the beginning of the next fiscal year. So, of course, it's up to the legislature to decide what it wants to do at that point.
Corrections officials could ask for more money as part of the supplemental budget next year or request additional funds for the next fiscal year budget cycle. Field studies looking at routes for a proposed gas pipeline from the North Slope to Canada are set to resume later this month around Delta Junction. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The corporate partnership known as the Alaska Pipeline Project will begin sending crews to survey the lay of the land from Delta to the Yukon border around May 20th. It's where they left off last summer after conducting field studies from the North Slope to Delta. TransCanada is exploring a route that would follow the oil pipeline, then head southeast from Delta to the north of the highway into Canada. Another proposed route to follow the oil pipeline corridor all the way to Valdez also is being explored by the Alaska Pipeline Project, which is the partnership firm of natural gas producer ExxonMobil and pipeline builder TransCanada. Alaska Pipeline officials say about 200 contractor engineers, scientists, and technicians will be working in crews along the proposed natural gas pipeline route over this summer. Among other things, they'll be studying soil permafrost, seismology, fish counts, wetlands, and archaeology and cultural resources. The company outlined a more detailed pipeline route than previous versions in the company's first resource report filed about 10 days ago with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Alaska Pipeline officials said in a recent meeting in Delta that if the project gets the go-ahead, construction of the pipeline would begin in 2015 and be completed in 2020. The company officials say construction would create about 7,000 jobs, and about 500 would be needed to operate and maintain the system over an estimated 30-year lifespan. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, making snowshoes at the Anchorage Museum.
This is a perfect example of how we like to see the gallery come alive with projects.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Ron Miller, the executive director of the Alaska Redistricting Board, died suddenly on Sunday. He was 65 years old. Miller spent the past 35 years in Alaska and has served under several governors. He worked as an international trade specialist under Governor Steve Cooper and served as executive director of the Alaska Industrial and Export Authority under Governor Frank Murkowski. Miller also served as executive director of the Alaska Energy Authority. Miller gained the respect of those he worked with. Taylor Bickford is deputy director of the Alaska Redistricting Board.
Ron was an absolute pleasure to work with. He's one of the hardest working people I've ever met. He's just completely dedicated to public service and to doing the best job he could, you know, no matter what the task in front of him was. And he had sort of an electricity about him, and he led by example. Those of us who had the opportunity to work for him in this process and the many, many Alaskans who have worked with him in the past just know him as a very thoughtful and honest, hardworking guy.
Bickford says he and the redistricting board members were shocked by the news of Miller's death.
We met as staff this morning, and our chairman flew in, and we took some time this morning to just reflect on the whole thing and kind of share some memories about Ron, and that was helpful. And I can tell you everyone's very sad. We're sad as we are. We know that, it's his family that, is really at a loss here, and we just, our thoughts and prayers are with them. And he loved his family very, very much, so we know that that's where the real impact is, but just as colleagues and friends, it's been difficult.
Miller leaves a wife, Oksana, and two children, Katya and Kolya. Miller's work for the redistricting board is considered crucial, according to Bickford.
But, we all feel sort of lucky that he was able to guide the process, to where we are today. And we've got a great staff. We've got a great board. We all feel like the best way to honor him is to just, see this process out. And today we're still grieving, but we know that we're prepared largely because of Ron's leadership to get the job done in the end.
The board's final redistricting plan is expected to be ready on June 14th. The Togiak Sacro herring fishery is now open. KDLG reporter Daisha Eaton flew with Alaska Department of Fish and Game biologists on Sunday and filed this report.
Despite rainy weather Sunday, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game made it out to do their fourth aerial herring survey this spring. And what they saw allowed them to open the Togiak Sacro herring fishery.
There's a school of fish.
There's some fish now.
These are big schools here, too.
Rather large.
I mean, it's clearly more than double what we saw the other day.
That's area management biologist for the Togiak Commercial Fishing District, Tim Sands. He's discussing what he's seeing from an airplane above the waters near Togiak Bay. During another aerial survey Friday, Sands calculated biologists saw a biomass of 15,000 tons of herring and predicted they'd open the fishery this weekend.
We saw herring in Togiak Bay and coming in along Hagemeister Island. We saw a ribbon of herring about 4 miles long that was probably 10 to 30 feet wide, and then a whole bunch of other small schools that were moving in towards Togiak Bay.
On Sunday, Sands says they saw more than double Friday's numbers, observing an estimated 40,000 tons of herring, exceeding the threshold biomass of 35,000 tons necessary to open the fishery. Sands says herring schools were concentrated between Anchor Point and Rocky Point. Biologists didn't see herring in Kalukuk Bay or along Cape Constantine. Commercial fishing with gillnets opened at 6 p.m. Sunday evening until further notice. The Togiak Sacro fishery is the largest herring fishery in Alaska. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The city of Sandpoint experienced another earthquake this morning. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, a 5.0 magnitude aftershock jolted the community at 11 o'clock. The Sandpoint Police Station says that no injuries or damage have been reported. Natasha Rupert is a seismologist with the Alaska Earthquake Information Center, and she says that the tremor took place in the same spot where two stronger earthquakes hit last Thursday. She adds that Sandpoint residents should expect more aftershocks in the coming days.
Most of the aftershocks occur within days of the main shock, but sometimes it takes a couple of weeks for this activity to go back to its normal background level. Definitely there will be more aftershocks this week for sure, and probably next week as well.
The epicenter of all three quakes was approximately 30 miles from Sandpoint. Juneau's annual Blessing of the Fleet was held on Saturday at the Alaska Commercial Fishermen's Memorial on the downtown waterfront. This is the 20th year the blessing has been held at the spot, and it could be one of the last. In the next few years, the memorial and blessing will be moved to make room for a planned $63 million expansion of Juneau's cruise ship docks. Bruce Wyrock with the memorial's board of directors says the new floating berths won't allow fishing boats to get close enough to shore to participate in the blessing.
The memorial was constructed here to take advantage of the open water and to allow vessels to pass in front of the memorial for the blessing of the fleet. Well, the construction of the new docks will prohibit the boats from being able to come up close to the memorial to be blessed. They'd be too far offshore and it would create a disconnect between the memorial and the open water.
Wyrock says the board is working with the city to find a new spot for the memorial. The preferred location is still downtown near Marine Park. He admits moving it is a sensitive issue.
It's akin to moving a graveyard for many people who have no place to recognize the people that have been lost at sea except for their names on the memorial. So we hope it can be handled sensitively, and we hope it can be handled smoothly in terms of a move. No one wants to move it, but if we're going to maintain the integrity of the memorial and its purpose, plus have it in a place of historic commercial fishing activity, it needs to be downtown, and that seems like the best spot.
Moving the memorial is expected to cost $2 million. Funding is already included in the city's spending plan for the new cruise ship docks.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
The Alaska Tribal Leaders Summit wrapped up in Anchorage over the weekend. The theme of the gathering was Securing a Future for Our Children. The conference dealt primarily with concerns over the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, or ANCSA, and the National Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, or ANILCA, and the current status of Alaska Native hunting and fishing rights. The keynote address was given by Ada Deer, a Menominee Nation tribal member and former Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs under Bruce Babbitt. Deer was instrumental in helping to solidify the federal recognition of Alaska's 229 tribes. She spoke to a packed room about the similarities of the Menominee's fight to regain their federal tribal status after the termination of their rights as a sovereign entity in the 1950s. The Menominee eventually prevailed and regained their federal status, and she says Alaska Natives can also get certain provisions of ANCSA repealed.
We both have a lot of similar issues, and I feel that it's essential that changes be made so that the cultures and the land and the people can be assured of a future.
Deer said although it's more complicated to get numerous tribes to unify on a consistent message rather than just one, as in the Menominee's case, it will be easier with current mass communications methods.
Yes, we have all these villages, but yes, we also have email, computers, and airplanes, and the issues are so important that action really needs to be taken.
She says the prospect of less control over tribal lands in the future and what she calls the disenfranchisement of Native youth from the corporate roles is something that will make the lives of young Alaska Natives more difficult in the future. She says this inequity offers all Alaskans a way to get involved.
So this will be an opportunity for people in the state of Alaska to take part in a very historic struggle and to contribute to a victorious result by demonstrating their sense of involvement and their devotion to the ideals of our country, you know, equal justice for all.
Deer says Alaska Native people will need bipartisan support at all levels to get this done. Mike Williams, senior of ACIAC, is a longtime advocate for change to ANCSA. He helped organize the conference. Williams says now that the conference has wrapped up, the next step will be for tribal leaders and advocates to strategize about how to repeal the 1971 extinguishment of Alaska Native hunting and fishing rights, dealing with the Venati decision where the U.S. Supreme Court ruled ANCSA lands are private property, not Indian country, and the afterborn issue.
Specifically, the 75,000 young Alaska Natives now that are living in our communities throughout Alaska that are not even shareholders of these corporations.
Williams says jurisdiction over tribal lands also needs to be addressed. He says ANCSA complicates what Native village residents can do with the lands they selected for hunting and fishing.
We're not even on the table of managing those resources right now. So I think there's a lot of work to do, work to be done, and I think we can hopefully work on those issues down the road.
Williams says he is in favor of tribes in Alaska being able to take land into trust to protect it from sale and taxation in the future. Last week, two Athabaskan master artists and a prominent culture bearer held a four-day workshop on traditional snowshoe making at the Anchorage Museum's Arctic Studies Center. The immediate purpose was to help three apprentices make their first pair of snowshoes, but as KSKA's Len Anderson reports, there were other goals as well.
When we put this part on,
yeah,
it's got to pull back a little ways.
Oh. Master artist George Albert of Ruby was showing apprentice William McCarty how to put the moose hide strips onto the nearly completed snowshoe. McCarty is also from Ruby. This was the first pair the young man had ever made. Albert, on the other hand, counts his shoemaking experience by the decades.
I used to wrap it all the way close like that, but it loosened up. So I don't do that no more. I do it like this so it'll dry.
This is a perfect example of how we like to see the gallery come alive with projects.
Aaron Kroll is the Alaska director of the Smithsonian's Arctic Studies Center, located on the second floor of the Anchorage Museum. Kroll explained how the center's workshop also fit into the Alaska State Council of the Arts Living Cultural Treasures program.
The focus there is on endangered arts, endangered art forms of Alaska. They had worked extensively with Athabascan communities to identify the top artists, the best makers of the snowshoes.
Besides Albert, there was also master snowshoe maker George Butch Yaska Sr. of Huslia and Athabascan culture bearer Gilbert Trimble of Arctic Village. Yaska started making snowshoes in the 1950s.
Everything got to be right, got to have enough turn, got to be wide enough. It got to be strong enough. The foot part where it got to be right towards the front, so when you lift your foot, the back end will go down and stay down. It doesn't, like if you're running, you don't have to watch your snowshoes that much.
Last week's teaching extended beyond apprentices. It also included student tours. Yaska regarded the appearance of the urban youngsters as an enjoyable break.
Students that come in here, we let them try the snowshoe on, and they're excited. They go home and tell everybody that, hey, I put on that snowshoe, and I made a circle over there and turned the snowshoe on, and boy, they're excited. They're happy.
Kroll says the master artists also participated in video sessions.
We will be producing a short version of the video sessions that we'll be posting that through the Arctic Studies Center website. We're intending to produce a 30 to 45 minute feature version about the whole workshop and then the related historical and cultural background.
Yaska says he makes only about 10 or so pairs a year, and those he prefers to sell locally.
People from outside or something, all they're going to do is hang it on the wall, but out in the village, they're going to use that. They're going to use that until it's worn out.
Albert, who sold 14 pairs at last year's Alaska Federation of Natives convention alone, has a different attitude.
They are a work of art. I mean, you're not supposed to brag about what you do, but they are beautiful. A lot of people just buy them to hang on the wall, and they are considered a work of art.
In fact, a pair of Albert's snowshoes are on exhibit in a downtown Anchorage art gallery. The Alaska State Council of the Arts, the Smithsonian Institution's Recovering Voices program, and the National Endowment for the Arts sponsored the four-day Snowshoe Master Artists Workshop. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
And that's it for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Tim Ellis in Delta, Daisha Eaton in Dillingham, Alexandria Gutierrez in Unalaska, Casey Kelly in Juneau, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Full Circle. Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at fullcircle.com.
And by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.